Notice the guy who wrote the words of that psalm, Tom Troger, was a seminary classmate of mine. Haven't seen him in about 40 years, but nice job, Tom, anyway. And when I was talking about some of our upcoming services a little later, I should have mentioned the also a service this evening to celebrate the winter solstice. And I know Anya, what time is that starting? 6 to 9, if you want to come down and observe the winter solstice. And I assume Anya will be in coffee hour if people have anything else they want to ask you about that. So thanks for doing that. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no rootless Christmas trees hung with candy canes and breakable stars. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where there were no gilded Christmas trees and no tinsel Christmas trees and no tinfoil Christmas trees and no pink plastic Christmas trees and no powder blue Christmas trees hung with electric candles and encircled by 10 electric trains and clever cornball relatives. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and ran away to where no intrepid Bible salesman covered the territory in two-tone Cadillacs and where no Sears Roebuck creches complete with plastic babe in a manger arrived by parcel post, the babe by special delivery. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest night of everyone's anonymous soul, he awaits again an unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception, the very craziest of second comings. First time I ever heard this poem, it was delivered with a British accent. I was in my sophomore year of college, and an honest-to-God English professor was spending the year on the Marshall University campus in some kind of a professorial exchange arrangement. And shortly before the Christmas break, he visited an English class I was taking, and in the course of his conversation with us, he said he had a Christmas poem by a Mr. Ferlinghetti that he wanted to read us. The name Lawrence Ferlinghetti meant nothing to me at the time. The professor read Christ Climbed Down in its entirety. It's kind of a long poem. What you heard here was a slightly abridged version, which first appeared in a collection of Ferlinghetti's poems that came out in 1958 called A Coney Island of the Mind. Well, back to the class. As the visiting English professor read it, I felt my breathing quicken a bit, and I went into frown mode. I couldn't quite pin it down, but I was sure I was hearing something sacrilegious. I was still firmly ensconced in my evangelical and near fundamentalist Baptist upbringing at the time, and anything that gave off even the slightest hint of making light of or demeaning Jesus Christ was simply not a good thing. And it sounded like Jesus was being trifled with and that the celebration of his birth was being ridiculed. And even though I knew that a lot of the trappings of the Christmas season, that this Mr. Ferlinghetti, whoever he was having a little fun with, and I knew all that really had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus at all, I still felt like my religion was being dissed by a stuffy British academic reading a poem written by some guy from California, which was a land way out there somewhere where I had never been. And then he got to the last lines. Christ climbed down from his bare tree this year and softly stole away into some anonymous Mary's womb again, where in the darkest of night of everybody's anonymous soul, he awaits again an unimaginable and impossibly immaculate reconception, the craziest of second comings. I didn't quite hear, much less fully grasp, all that was being said in those last few lines, but the idea that the second coming, the very craziest of second comings as the line goes, is really a rebirth of all that Jesus represented within everyone's anonymous soul, That idea switched on a light bulb for me. This wasn't quite the same Jesus as the supernatural Savior whom God had dispatched to suffer and die for my sins. And that was something I doggone well better believe in if I wanted to escape the punishments of hell. But the idea that everyone's anonymous soul was the true locale of the craziest of second comings, well, it caught me off guard. It made a crazy kind of sense in a way that actually frightened me. It frightened me because it posed a challenge to my religious worldview at the time, a view that I was doggedly determined that I was going to hold on to in the face of all this quote-unquote liberal thought I was being exposed to, even in a state university in southern West Virginia. Well, it will be far from correct to say that my whole 19-year-old religious worldview came tumbling down in that moment, because it didn't. I did not walk out of the classroom as a suddenly reborn religious liberal. That was a process that took a few more years. But hearing this poem, especially the last verse that comes after Ferlinghetti has had a little fun getting in his jabs at some of our occasional seasonal silliness, that last verse provided one of the first cracks in my near fundamentalist consciousness as to what the true nature of not just Christianity but religion itself, what it might and could be. In much more recent years, I've had the opportunity on a couple of occasions actually to meet and chat with the author of this and scores of other poems that he wrote. I don't know how many of you have ever had the experience of coming face to face with somebody who had a hand in rearranging your brains, but I found it was kind of a mind-blowing experience. I actually got the chance to thank Larry Ferlinghetti for making a mess out of my life sometime back when, and helping to set me on a path that in time got me to the Unitarian Universalist ministry. Well, I'll do a little more with this poem in a few minutes, but first I'd like to take you on a brief side excursion into the life of this author. It's a fascinating story, and I know I've told parts of it before in other sermons, so if you've heard any of this already, I'm going to ask your forbearance for the next couple of minutes, or a few minutes anyway. Lawrence Ferlinghetti, by all indications, grew up a pretty straight arrow, nice Italian Catholic boy from Yonkers, New York in the 1920s and 30s. He was an accomplished student. He was an Eagle Scout. He reported for active duty when the Second World War broke out. And by the time D-Day arrived, he was a lieutenant commander in the Navy, and he commanded a submarine chaser as part of that momentous Normandy invasion. And then about a year and a half later, he was relocated to Nagasaki, Japan, in the aftermath of the atomic bomb being dropped on that city. And that proved to be the experience that rearranged his brain. The rationale for dropping the bomb notwithstanding, Ferlinghetti's awareness of the human capacity to inflict mass death upon other human beings made an indelible impression upon the young lieutenant commander. He reflected on that experience about 6-7 years ago at an interview he gave with the San Francisco Chronicle. He said, "Before I was at Nagasaki, I was a good American boy. I was the commander of a sub-chaser in the Normandy invasion. Anyone who saw Nagasaki would suddenly realize that they'd been kept in the dark by the government as to what atomic bombs can really do." Well, I believe it was his witnessing death on such a massive scale, it was witnessing death on such a massive scale, which demonstrated the utter fragility of life. That was an event that challenged many of those who were of an artistic, poetic, or literary bent to become advocates for life in the face of the possibility of widespread human destruction. The event made life look cheap and highly expendable. It raised the question, how then do we stand for life's essential holiness when life has become this easily extinguished and expended? And that was the challenge that faced the generation coming of age during and after the Second World War. And this was the kind of consciousness that was part of the impetus that gave rise to what came to be called the Beat Generation writers. So wherever Ferlinghetti's life may have been headed, it took a turn after his World War II experience. The war ended. He studied for a time at the Sorbonne in Paris, where he earned a doctorate. Then he settled into San Francisco, where in 1952 he and a partner opened up a bookstore and a small press outfit, and they gave it the Charlie Chaplin-esque name of City Lights. City Lights Bookstore, City Lights Press, which operates to this day. That store and that press became one of the primary outlets for the literature of the Beat Movement. And the man who was one of the midwives, as it were, of this movement, and who now, at age 92, has become its elder statesman, he's still going strong. As a poet, a painter, an essayist, still even keeps an office there at the City Lights Books. Well, while as noted, Mr. Ferlinghetti was raised Catholic, he has come to disavow or move away from Christianity as a matter of faith and doctrine. But as this and other of his poems indicate, he remains fascinated with the person of Jesus and his continuing presence in our world. And the same goes for me on both counts. And it's Ferlinghetti's poem, from one, as you will, non-Christian to another, that helps provide me with a reason to continue to honor and celebrate the birth of Jesus. I mentioned earlier that my hearing of Christ climb down for the first time was what got me to thinking, but I didn't have any way to go with what I was thinking or what the impression it made upon me at that time. It didn't cause an instant change, as I already said, in my religious beliefs. I had neither a language I could speak nor a framework of understanding in my mind that allowed me to get a good handle on what it was I was trying to grasp. Well, that came later. It came as I realized that myths and legends are not primarily about events that happened out there somewhere in time and geographical space. They're much more about what happens in here, inside all of us, instead. So yes, I believe that someone named Jesus of Nazareth did live and carry forth a ministry that's approximated in the New Testament Gospels. But those Gospels are shrouded in myth and legend. And myths and legends, as I just said, are about things that happened, and as Mr. Ferlinghetti also put it, in everybody's anonymous soul. I don't know if it was immaculate or not, but when I finally grasped that, it was a significant and very meaningful reconception for me. If, as I came to see, there are going to be any second comings, the craziest kind or not, they will come and only come in the lives we choose to lead, in the values we seek to embody or to incarnate, and the willingness on our parts to be bearers of life and life abundant in the face of the many kinds of deaths that diminish, demean, belittle, or destroy life. For the Christian, the message in this story or legend or myth is that God decided to give humanity another chance by appearing on earth as a human being. First in the form of a helpless child, and later, when the child grew up, as an adult human being who tried to bring to those with whom he came into contact a fuller realization of their own humanity, while also teaching the ways of love and compassion and justice. A side note, that the lives and teaching of this wise and humble man and the religion that came to be generated in his name have become in the hands of some, and I will emphasize only some, has become in the hands of some an instrument for perpetuating bigotry and fear and division is something that infuriates me nearly above all else. But that's has been a subject for other sermons. I want to stay on the goodwill side of the street today. I respect and honor the Christian interpretation of this legend. As a religious humanist, the message I take from it is that life keeps giving us another chance and another challenge with each new life that comes into the world from some anonymous Mary's womb. How we respond to that challenge is, as I just noted, in our hearts and in our hands. We've each and all been given a life which we can use to say yes to those things that nurture and enhance life and no to the principalities and powers that would diminish or destroy it. We can use our life to be a witness for peace even in the face of all that threatens or denies us peace. And within this community here, we can use the lives we've been given to attend to and celebrate as we do the joys that are in our midst. I can reach out to those as well who are experiencing their times of pain or loss or despair, things that inevitably get visited upon each of us at some point or points in our lives. And so in the story of the birth of Jesus, I see a paradigm for each new life that comes into the world. And a reminder that each new life is also about my life. It's about our lives. And it's about the human responsibilities to which each new and living life calls us. One of my predecessors in this pulpit from the late 1940s, the late Reverend Ernest Summerfield, he penned some words that might in his mind have been part of an imaginary dialogue he was having with a more traditional colleague or friend, and for all I know, he may have said them from this very pulpit. Reverend Summerfield, why do you celebrate Christmas? You do not believe in virgin birth. You don't believe that Jesus was a deity. You probably do not believe in angels. True. But we believe in songs, which are born of the hearts and minds of people. We believe that some stories deserve to live forever because of what they tell us about ourselves. The angels singing an anthem of peace and goodwill deserve to be heard forever because there are angels in human hearts. The humble shepherds who have eyes to hear and hearts to receive a message of joy deserve to live in our hearts to the end of time. The wise men so faithfully seeking the way of a star deserve to go in search again each year for as long as years shall be, for they are the story of the quest for ourselves. A few summers ago, during one of our Ferry Beach weekends in June, I happened to meet up with one of Reverend Summerfield's sons, who just happened to be up there for some other event that was taking place. He and I had a very pleasant conversation. His father's ministry here, for a number of reasons, was a fairly short-lived one, but he told me about how his father got into some hot water when on a Sunday prior to Thanksgiving, he wanted to take up a collection to benefit some worthy cause in the community. And I told him about our outreach collections and how we've gotten past that now. I think he was glad to hear it. I'm going to close by going back to some of the words just quoted. When Reverend Summerfield says that the Christmas story is the story of a quest for ourselves, he was not, I am sure, saying that in any kind of narcissistic or self-indulgent way. He meant that it's a quest to know our deeper selves, our truer selves, our healed and reconciled selves, and our most hopeful selves. Most important, it's about the selves we have to offer and to share with one another. So my hope is that the stories, both modern and ancient, and the myths that are related at this time of year will aid and inspire all of us on such a quest for ourselves as well. With that in mind, let's sing together number 228. It's Once in Royal David City.